I know that if you are a visitor, you could not have helped but sense the joy and the pride we have in this place. There is an enormous pressure on any organized group to be like the world in which it finds itself. So it's no surprise to discover how well churches learn to operate as if they were little sisters of the great free enterprise system, ingenious ways of raising money to meet the budget, concern about property, measuring success by how big the building is and how many people come into it, hiring senior ministers who resemble corporate executives far more than they resemble any prophet we read about in the Bible. So when I picked up a book the other day, which in its title defines the church as a group of resident aliens, I wondered whether anybody would believe that. Hollywood has made the word alien unpleasant more often than not. Creatures who don't look like us or act like us. But here is a book which says that the church's true mission is to be a kind of counterculture, to stand in judgment, to be alien rather than indigenous, different from Rotary or the Lions Club, not always a booster, but sometimes a critic, holding a different vision from the majority of what the good life is. I wondered this week to what extent anybody in this church, in almost any church, believes that. The book calls the church an outpost, an island of one culture in the midst of another, or in a phrase they got from St. Augustine, a colony of resident aliens, people who are away from home, people whose ultimate allegiance is not to the world in which they find themselves. Are you as surprised as I am sometimes by how much you want to be like everybody else, by the almost irresistible force of what the majority thinks, and by how easy it is when you worry if giving in may not be silly or wrong, to calm yourself by the cliche that, after all, everybody does it? When there was a brief scandal one time about American firms using illegal bribes to get foreign trade, I asked a prominent leader in another church about his own company, and he said, "You do it or you don't do business." What surprised me, I suppose, since we were inside the church at the time, was that he didn't even think about ethics, but only about expediency. Talk anywhere about the compassion and mercy required of the individual Christian, and someone quickly says, "Hey, try that stuff in a world like this, and you'll be eaten alive." So we have to remind ourselves once in a while that we belong to a tradition in which there have always been people willing to swim against the current. If you want a compelling example of that, you can find it in an offhand comment by the Apostle Paul in one of his letters to a young church. Unobtrusive, easily overlooked. It reads like this at the very end of the letter. All the saints salute you, especially the ones that live in Caesar's house. Followers of the Jewish Christ, living in a Roman Caesar's palace, it's hard to imagine. That particular Caesar, if you have forgotten, was Nero. And if ever there was a strange place for somebody to be a Christian, it would be in that household. Nero put his own mother to death, forced the philosopher Seneca to commit suicide, executed his wife, Octavia, and his uncle, blamed the Christians when Rome burned, and had scores of them sent into the arena to be killed by wild animals. What an incredible thing it is that in the very household of this paranoid assassin, there were servants who had given their allegiance to a crucified Jew whom they had never seen. They remind me of those tough and determined blades of grass that live against all the odds in a parking lot. Not in a lush green lawn, but in an alien environment where everything says, give up. We sit in a pleasant sanctuary like this and adopt a covenant that approves of justice, peace, and brotherhood. And almost as soon as we are out again in the workaday world, we give up on them because the tides of prejudice and hatred are too strong for us. And yet here were people trying to live by a different code right in the very house of one of the most brutal tyrants in history. We despair at the gross amusements that brutalize public taste. We wonder why anyone would pay money to hear the Two Live Crew degrade human life. But it isn't really new. If you've ever seen the famous frescoes at Pompeii, you can imagine what it would have been like to attempt Christian morality in Nero's court. If there were people in that sty of filth who could serve a totally different master, if on that dunghill the flowers of kindness and pity could blossom, then this is what it means, that no one in any time or place should claim that it is impossible to live well in a hostile environment. The truth is that the environment in many ways is always hostile. I still remember how surprised I was when I realized in the first geography class how little of the whole Earth's surface is really friendly to people. 3/4 uninhabitable ocean, huge wastelands of ice and snow at the poles, much of it desert, much of it disease-ridden rainforest, only here and there some places relatively hospitable to human beings. Relatively, because even in those places, we make it against the odds. I sympathize with a New England farmer whose congregational minister came out to visit. The place seemed to have almost no soil, just rocks, and it had been a dismal failure in years past. But this farmer, by tireless work, had made it into a mild success. Musing at what he saw and meaning to pay a compliment, the minister said, "Well, I see that God and you are getting on very well here." To which the farmer replied, "That's true. But you should have seen this place when God had it all by himself." We need that kind of spunk, because without it, the odds will bury most of us. There will be plenty of rocks where we try to plant our hopes, accidents, disease, wrong turns, bad luck. And it's a sheer waste to sit around lamenting how well we might have done if only things had been better. I can hear the protest already rising in some thoughtful minds. Sounds good, they think. But does this speaker have any idea what it's like to be born in a slum or a ghetto, or to grow up suffocated daily by contempt for your faith or your deformity? Can anyone really be expected to struggle against those currents? My answer will not be cruel, I hope, because no decent person could ignore those handicaps. But my answer is that these excuses must always be for others and not for ourselves. It is gracious to say of others that circumstances made them fail, that fate kicked them around, and that they deserve only pity. But when we assess our own lives, we avoid that excuse. We believe, no matter how contrary the evidence, that it is not environment that is completely our master. Or if that faith fails us, then we believe that it may be within our power to change the environment that will master us. I know people who cry out that they cannot live differently where they are, yet they still have power to move, and they will not. Not everybody can move, I know that. But there are always some redeeming elements, even in the small circle where we are forced to live out our days. Those saints in Caesar's household, that little band of resident aliens who supported one another, who met in secret and swore allegiance to another kingdom. Think what those clandestine meetings must have been like. Moments of friendship in a world of enemies. So if we can't keep from being influenced by our friends, and I think we cannot, then we need to choose our friends wisely. Children fret when their parents worry about their choice of friends, but parents remember very well which of their own friends dragged them down and which ones made them better. And as weak and imperfect as the church was, in my years of growing up, I think that without it, I might very well have chosen worse friends and made far more serious mistakes than the ones I have made. This meeting we've come to this morning, this church we have become, if it really is a kind of counterculture, what is the driving force behind it? What is the church, anyway? And the answer that seems true to me, even when I betray it, is that the church is the incarnation, for the second time, of the man we know as Jesus, who now lives through the church, or for any practical purposes, does not live at all. When he died the first time, His disciples were desolate until they realized that they could provide him with hands and feet again, that they could become the dwelling place for his fierce and tender spirit. The story of the ascension is open to misunderstanding, I think, if you get too literal-minded about it. A Jesus zipping through the universe at the speed of light toward some far edge of the farthest galaxy to sit by the right hand of his Father, that's hard to make a living reality in a church of highly intelligent Christian people. The old Byzantine image of the triumphant Christ enthroned above the clouds, surrounded by a company of adoring angels, is far removed from the world we live in. If Christ has any reality, he has to be seen among the resident aliens in the community called the church. That community has to be his voice, has to ask the questions by which he tried to awaken dead lives, embarrassing questions sometimes, questions the rest of the world does not want to hear. The church has to keep saying things that sound as alien now as when they were first spoken. You know what they are. Things like, if you wish to save your life, you have to throw it away for something good. Swallow your pride and walk the second mile. Forgive not sparingly the way the world does, not once or twice, but 70 times 7. Until you will seem like a holy idiot. All those things it was so hard to understand in the first place. Two girls were fussing one day in a class of mine about which was the last book of the Bible. And one of them said, "Barbara, I'm telling you, the Bible does not end in Timothy. It ends in Revolutions." She was technically wrong, but gloriously right. Because taken seriously, in a fallen world, it always ends in revolutions. In some ways, dearest of friends, we, even now, live in Caesar's house. If there is no sense at all in which we are subversive, if the image of the resident alien seems only ridiculous, something is wrong.